Well, in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, Christian comes to the Delectable Mountains, where the shepherds keep their flocks. And from the Delectable Mountains, you can see the gates of the celestial city. It's a beautiful picture, isn't it? Shepherds, pastors, do their work within sight of heaven itself. And as the word is opened, what is the shepherd doing? Well, he's putting the telescope of God's word to your eyes, so that you can see the glory of Emmanuel's land. So brothers, sisters, onward, upward. Heaven is in sight. Now, 2 weeks ago, we took a break from John chapter 17 to think about glory. And this morning, we're still on pause, if you like. We have yet to go back to John 17. So we're going to have another message on heaven. But it's a little bit back to front, in the sense that last time we looked at the end of Revelation 21, beginning of Revelation 22. We entered the inner sanctuary last time. Today we're going to look at the beginning of chapter 21. So we're sort of in an outer room rather than the inner sanctuary, but I hope you'll agree with me, the view is still wonderful. So please come with me to Revelation 21 and verses 1 to 8. And we have three snapshots of heaven. So point number one, a new creation. So chapter 21 and verse 1, John says, "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea." The old order is gone, and gone forever. Says John, "I saw a new heaven and a new earth." So listen to how Peter describes the passing of the old order, the passing of this universe. You may want to turn to it. It's 2 Peter and chapter 3. This is what Peter says. And verse 10. "But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolved, being on fire, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for the new heavens and the new earth in which righteousness dwells." Think of it. Says Peter, the universe itself will be on fire. The heavens passing away with a great noise. As the little girl said, God loves noise. Every possession, building, city, valley, mountain, continent, planet, star, galaxy, the whole created order melting, dissolving, burning, laid bare. But every mark of sin, every defilement of the curse is cleansed and purged and purified by fire. And from the old will come the new, a new heavens and a new earth where only righteousness dwells. "Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." Now how new is the new? Well, it's not brand new. There's a perfectly good Greek word for that, but it's not the word that's used here. The new here means a transformation. It's a rejuvenation of the old. Not resuscitation, but resurrection. What Jesus calls the regeneration. What Peter calls the restoration. Now think of it like this. When Christ rose from the dead, was it in the same body in which he died? Well, the answer is yes, but no. Yes, but it's a body now glorified, a body free forever from the curse. It wasn't resuscitation, was it? It was resurrection. Lazarus was raised from the dead, but he died again. Jesus Christ is risen, never more to die. And the resurrection of his body is the first fruit of the full resurrection of the universe. His resurrection guarantees that resurrection. But think about Jesus' body. What does it bear? Well, it bears the marks of the cross, doesn't it? Come, Thomas, put your finger here, put your hand there. So just as Jesus bears the scars of the cross in his glorified body, so the new heavens and the new earth will in some way bear the scars of the fall. It's not brand new. But do those scars mar his body? No, they add to his glory, don't they? Because we can look at them and say, the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. And in the same way, whatever mark will be left by the fall, it will only add to the beauty of the glorified universe. A new heaven and a new earth. Paul talks about it like this. Come with me to Romans chapter 8 for a moment. Romans 8 verse 20. This is Paul's take on things. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself will also be delivered from the bondage of corruption or the bondage of decay into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Now here's a play. And on the opening night, the principal actor goes missing. And the rest of the cast think, well, that's been a waste of time. What's the point? When Adam sinned, the creation was subjected to futility. Not willingly. The principal actor goes missing. And creation is subjected to futility. What's the point? It's not what the creation would have chosen. It's what God did to the creation. But that's not the end of the story, because Paul tells us God subjected it in hope. What are the cast of the play waiting for? They're waiting for the restoration of the lead actor. And when that happens, then the play can begin. And so says Paul, verse 19, when the sons of God are revealed, when, verse 21, the children of God come of age, then the play can begin. Then the creation will be set free. It will be restored, regenerated, made new. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of decay into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Look at verse 22. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Creation groans, doesn't it? There's a steam train going past. Creation groans, doesn't it? If only the world was full of kittens, fluffy kittens. But kittens grow, don't they? To bite and scratch and scar and kill. If only the world was full of soft bunny rabbits. But rabbits scream as they're killed by foxes. And if you leave rabbits to breed, they'll turn your green and pleasant land into a wasteland. Yeah, but if only the world was full of songbirds. A nesting pair in your back garden will raise, on average, in a season, 7 young. By next spring, 6 of those young will be dead, and one of the parents. For we know the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. The creation's like a woman in labor. And sometimes those birth pangs are unbearable. Creation screams. But just as labor is not the end, it brings forth a child, so, says Paul, this present groaning is not the end. This present creation will give birth to a new creation. And it can't wait. Verse 19, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. Or as another translation puts it more helpfully, the creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. So creation's on tiptoes, waiting for the day. waiting for the new heavens and the new earth. Now I saw a new heaven and new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Let me read this strange phrase. And there was no more sea. Now we all know what the sea can do. In the beginning, the sea covered the earth till God forced it back. At the flood, the sea broke its chains and again covered the earth. The sea came close to destroying everyone, didn't it? And the sea still threatens. We've all learnt a new word in the last few years, tsunami. The sea's like a wild dog. It's untrained, which God has chained up. But any moment it might break its chains and come bounding back. The threatening chaos, making this world uninhabitable. What's more, if you read through Scripture, sea becomes, in picture terms anyway, comes to represent the activity of Satan. You can look up, for example, Psalm 74, Isaiah 27, Isaiah 51. And the sense is the sea blocking the way to the promised land. Think of the Red Sea blocking the people's path in the Exodus. But now what do we read? There was no more sea. Christian friends, the new heavens and the new earth are to be our home forever. There's no sea to threaten. No activity of Satan. He can't assault anymore. There's nothing to threaten this new creation. And we'll have reached the everlasting rest of the promised land. What did Jesus say? The meek shall inherit the earth. Well, the second snapshot is a bride prepared. Look at verse 2. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. So what's the New Jerusalem? Well, it's the church, isn't it? It's the whole number of the redeemed. And Christian friends, how are we described? How's the church described? As a bride adorned for her husband. Christian friends, the day is coming when we shall be clothed with resurrection bodies. We'll no longer be walking around in these tatty tents that grow ever more threadbare. Our pilgrimage will be over. The tent will have got us across the wilderness. And then these tents, these bodies, these temporary homes, they'll have done their job. And I'll be finished with this body forever. But then, says Paul, 2 Corinthians 5, our naked spirits will then enter their permanent dwelling. Not a tent, because that speaks of something being temporary and you're on a journey, but a heavenly home, as Paul describes it, a resurrection body. The way C.S. Lewis talks about it, he says it's like at the end of the day, when you've been labouring hard and you've been working and you've got your shirt and your shirt is dirty and it's sweaty and it's filthy and you sort of peel your shirt off and step into the shower. In the same way, we'll strip off these soiled, ugly, shameful bodies. It's the stuff of 1 Corinthians 15, isn't it? We'll strip off this old mortality, this corruptible body, to be clothed with glorious, incorruptible resurrection bodies. Romans 8 again, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. You look at a photograph, a school photograph or a wedding photograph. Can you tell from the photograph who the children of God are? Just by looking at the photograph. Well, you can't, can you? But on that day, who is a child of God will be revealed for all to see. They will be clothed in their wedding garments. Paul talks about it like this, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. We'll have glorious bodies. which will reflect the glory of God himself. Jesus says, will shine forth like the sun in the kingdom of our Father. Angels will look into our faces and they'll fall back as they see in us the beauty of holiness. In John's words, we shall be like him, a bride prepared. As Christ mirrors the Father, so the bride will mirror Christ. She shall look like him. She will perfectly express and reveal and reflect his glory. She's a bride adorned for her husband. The day has come. Perfection is here. And when he sees the sight of his bride, of his church, he will be ravished at the sight of her. No wonder Paul talks about the glory that will be revealed in us. It's a new creation, a bride prepared. And number three, an everlasting home. Now, I saw a new heaven and new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Did you catch the picture? When God created the first heaven and the first earth, only when everything was ready did he create man and bring man into that garden paradise. And only now, when all is ready, when our home has been prepared to perfection, only then does the Lord bring his bride into her new home. And the whole sense of it, isn't it, is he, the bridegroom, is carrying his bride across the threshold into the new heavens and the new earth and saying, darling, this is our home forever. This is where we belong together forever. Verse 3, and I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. Now, before we go any further, let's just try and catch something of what this means. Okay, as we thought about last time, so often we think of heaven as a stained glass window. Well, who wants to go and live in a stained glass window? Resurrection bodies. On that resurrection Sunday, the disciples meet in secret. The doors are shut. And yet Jesus in his resurrection body comes and stands among them. The implication is he can walk through walls. And the terrified disciples think they've seen a ghost. And Jesus has to reassure them. He says, does a spirit have flesh and bones as I have? Nathan Wilson puts it like this. He says, when Christ rose, he rose in the flesh. He was no ghost. And yet he walked through walls. The walls were the ghosts, and so are we. Do you see? That resurrection body, that's the real body. That's the real flesh. It's these bodies which are temporary, transient, fading. Compared to that body, these bodies are the ghosts. In that sense, this is the unreal world. This is the temporary world, the passing world. It serves a purpose for a time, and then it's gone. A resurrection body. Last time we thought, didn't we, about what it says in chapter 21, verse 23. The city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God illuminated it. The Lamb is its light. We thought about the unmediated glory of God. In this world, the glory of God is revealed, but that glory is mediated through the sun and the moon. You can't see the glory of God directly. It's mediated through things that he's made. But when we get to glory, we'll see his glory as it is. It won't be mediated through the sun. It won't be mediated through the moon. It'll shine and we'll see it as it is. But again, think about it. Tell me, with these eyes, can you stare at the sun? Can you with these eyes stare at the mediated glory? No. But on that day, chapter 2, verse 4, we shall see his face. With new eyes, we'll be able to gaze upon the unmediated glory. We'll be able to look directly at a glory that is brighter than the sun. See, these bodies are the ghosts. Then we'll have the real eyes, made for the real world, made for looking upon God himself. What of our other senses? What of senses we don't yet possess? And our powers undimmed and untainted by the curse. And what would it be like to know the fullness of the Spirit of God in these new temples? It'll be a body that's made to house the Spirit of God forever. But the Spirit of God in all its fullness. If God's Spirit came in all its fullness in this body, it would burn up. It would be consumed. These bodies are the ghosts. It's the real flesh. It's the real body. And the new eyes will gaze upon the surpassing wonder of the new heavens and the new earth. Christian friends, if this world is full of the Lord's glory, and it is, isn't it? Everything is an echo, a whisper, a reflection of God himself. So when it says that God is a rock, it's not that God is like a rock and there's a rock and God is like the rock. It's that God's the original and every rock is like the original. Everything in this creation is like sparks that have flown off the burning bush, the eternal flame. But it's a fallen world, isn't it? It has glory, but it's a fallen world. So what will it be like when creation fully reveals the glory of God? The very stones will capture our gaze. Because we'll see God in them in a way that we've never imagined or thought or comprehended in this world. Everything will blaze with the glory of God. And you see, in this creation, in this world, there's a dislocation between the spiritual and the physical. Do we see angels? Well, some people have seen angels. Some people have sat down and had a meal with angels, haven't they? They've entertained angels unawares. So we do see angels, but we don't really, do we? Psalm 18 puts it like this. Talks about the Lord. He says, he rode upon a cherub, that's an angel, and flew. He flew upon the wings of the wind. It's interesting, isn't it? He flew upon the angel, but he flew upon the wind. But which does God fly on? Does he fly on the angel or does he fly on the wind? Well, the answer is both. There's a relationship, you see, even in this creation, between the spiritual and the physical. I haven't got time to go into it, but you look at Ezekiel 1, where you have these cherubim carrying the chariot of God. There's an interweaving, an interpenetration of the angelic world and this physical world. That's, of course, why all the powers of darkness, the demonic world, can operate in this physical world and do physical harm in this physical world. There's an interweaving, but we don't yet really see it, do we? As far as we're concerned, the wind just blows. We don't see there's an angelic element to it, but there is. But we can't see it. There's a dislocation between the physical and the spiritual. There are dimensions which are hidden from our eyes. Because it's a fallen world. There's been a great divorce between the spiritual and the natural. But on that day, in the new heavens and new earth, the true relationship will again be restored. It's the restoration. The relationship between the physical and the spiritual. The divorce will be over between the natural and the angelic. It'll all be put back together again. You see, we'll gaze upon perfection forever. And one of those moments when you felt creation stir, that you felt creation, that it was capable of something altogether more glorious, and yet that sense that it can't break its chains, it's in bondage, it's been subjected to futility. I remember in Prince Caspian, Lucy remembers the days when the trees could talk. He says, oh trees, wake. And though there was not a breath of wind, they all stirred about her. The rustling noise of the leaves was almost like words. The nightingale stopped singing to listen to it. And Lucy felt at any moment she would begin to understand what the trees were trying to say. But the moment didn't come. The rustling died away. The nightingale resumed its song. Now, it's only a story. But it's not strange to us, is it? Because we were made to rule over the works of God's hands. And the creation was made to move and to stir at the voice of the children of God. And for all those dimensions of which we've spoken to come into play. But it doesn't at the moment, because the creation's in bondage, it's chained, it's been subject to futility. But it waits for the earnest expectation of the creation, eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. So what will it be like on that day when all the chains are broken? And again, creation hears the voices and laughter of the children of God. Isaiah puts it like this, "For you shall go out with joy and be led forth with peace, and the mountains and the hills shall break forth into singing before you, and the trees of the field shall clap their hands." And who's to say that singing isn't real? And who's to say the clapping of those hands is not real? Especially when we think about that angelic element. Do you see, it's a universe that's thrown off the shackles. It's thrown off the curse. It's a universe that lives. Try and get away from a stained glass window. What do you love about this creation? Is it the freshness after a storm, and you go out and the air's so clear and it's beautiful, isn't it? Or maybe it's the crash of the waves. And you feel the saltiness on your lips. Or the magic of the snowfall. Or when you stand on the edge of a cliff. I know every mother will say, get back. But you stand on the edge of a cliff and you feel the danger. Or the beauty of a rainbow. And everyone says, look. Even when you're 50 years old, you still say, look, rainbow. Or the majesty of a lion. Or the cheeriness of a budgie. God makes a budgie. You know, you get male budgies. They're no bigger than that, are they? And they speak and they chatter as though they rule the world. And they're relentlessly cheerful. Or the brush of a butterfly's wing. Or there's just the sheer madness of a walrus. Think of a walrus. What Christmas will be in our home. And in the new heavens and new earth, these things won't be any less. We won't be going from the exciting things, the wonderful things, the great things, the things that stir you, the things that move you, to a stained glass window. As though, oh, this is great, I don't want to leave this world behind, because after that it's all clouds and sitting around doing nothing. This is the faded, sepia-tinted photograph. This is the Tesco blue stripe. This creation. Then you go to the real creation, where everything's released and the chains are off, and you see it as it really supposed to be. So if these things thrill you and fill you with pleasure, what will it be like, Christian friend, when you're there? And there'll be a creation under our feet. You got a pet dog? It's not wild, is it? Doesn't run with the pack. At times you'd say your dog is almost human. Because under your headship, it reveals something of your image, doesn't it? You've humanized your dog. I know he's only ever a dog, but you've humanized it in a way. But on that day, all creation will be under our feet. Look at Psalm 8, read about it. All creation will bear something of our image. All creation will be humanized. Isaiah again. Isaiah 11, if I can find it. Here we are. Isaiah 11, verse 6. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb. The leopard shall lie down with the goat. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze. Their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play by the cobra's hole, and the weaned child shall put his hand in the viper's den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. But don't misunderstand, that new creation is not sort of Disneyfied. The lions won't be cute. If they were cute, they'd cease to be lions, wouldn't they? They're the real lions. They're awesome, majestic, and yes, they will be a bit scary. But they'll be under our feet and responding to our words and our pleasures. One angel appears to shepherds and they're terrified. On that day, the children of God will be judging the angels and will rule over the works of God's hands. There'll be nothing that isn't put under our feet, and we'll rule with Christ at his side as his bride. And we'll run and not grow weary. And what horizons will be out there to explore? Can all this really be for me? Our everlasting home. As we rush to a close, look again at verse 3. What makes heaven a home? And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. He will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. Now in the wilderness, God dwelt among his people in the tabernacle. But now you see, we're inside the tabernacle. Inside the true tabernacle. God's home is now our home. The love, the glory, the perfections of heaven have now expanded to fill the entire renewed universe. It's all tabernacle. Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. What will make it home? God will be with us. That's what will make it. That's what makes it home. Today, you see, Christian friends, a separation. Can I see Jesus? No. Can I hear his voice? Well, yes, but no. I can't hear it with these ears. I've never heard him call me by my name in that way. Do I hear, feel the fullness of his love? No. There's always a distance, isn't there, in this world? There's some dark providence or indwelling sin. Or there's the corruption of my heart and mind, so I just don't see things as they really are. And there's the assaults of the devil, and there's the hatred or the seductions of the world. God is with us, of course he is. But we can't escape that sense of separation. Because we're pilgrims, we're passing through, we're strangers in an alien world, far from home. But you see, heaven is home. It's God's home, and it's our home. If someone invites you to their home, you're getting to know the real them, aren't you? And in their home, you see them at their ease. You see them as themselves. And maybe as you're watching, you see them with their children. And they're playing with their children. And they're wrestling with their children. And sometimes they're tickling their children and giving their children piggybacks and maybe rolling on the grass or swinging their children in the air, and the children are laughing and they're laughing. What would it be like to come home to my Heavenly Father? No more distance. No more separation. to see my Father as himself in all his fullness, relaxing with his children, playing with his children, when all the children, all his children have come home to be with their Father. And what do children do when they're with their Father and they're having a wonderful time with their Father? What do? They say, do it again, don't they? Do it again, and again, and again. Because they never tire of the joy of being with their Father. And we'd be saying to Father, again, again, again. Maybe you think, well, we're saying too much here. But how does Zechariah describe the new Jerusalem? He says, the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing. That's how he describes heaven. The streets are full of boys and girls playing. They've come home. They're safe. They're with Father. And they'll never tire of the joy. It won't feel strange. How can you feel strange when it's home? It's where you've always belonged. And my Father is here. It's the place I've always looked for, but perhaps never quite realized I was looking for it. And when I get there, I'll say, yes, this is what I was looking for. Because this is my home. And I'm home. But if he behaves like a father, he'll also behave like a mother. Look at verse 4. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. He doesn't send an angel to wipe away their tears. God can't stop himself. He will wipe away our tears. Did you never run home crying? Your mother wiped away your tears and said, it's all right, you're home now. And verse 4, no more death. The last enemy will be slain. And we'll dance upon the grave of death and say, death, oh death, where is your sting? I've had the last word over you, death. Death is not the end, it's just the beginning. And it says, verse 4, no more sorrow. Are you sad this morning, Christian friend? Have you ever had a dream and you've woken up upset and you go, oh, and then you, oh, it's such a relief, it's just a dream, it's a new dream. We'll wake up to a new day, won't we? An eternal day. No more sorrow. It'll be like a dream that vanishes. And verse 4, no more crying. I will shed my last tear. Heaven will be the place of perfect comfort. And verse 4, no more pain. All that gives us pain. Our besetting sins. Loved ones that remain unsaved. The dysfunction of my mind and of my body. Living as a stranger in this cursed world. Well, all those things belong to this creation. And with the passing of this creation, they will be no more. Verse 4, for the former things have passed away. There will be nothing to bring to mind the pains and the sorrows, Christian friends, of this life. Then look at verse 5. Then he who sat on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. Does that sound too good to be true? He said to me, write. For these words are true and faithful. What God has said, he says, is true. It's faithful. Does it sound too good to be true? But it is true, says God. Here are words to build your life upon. His promise cannot fail. But, no buts, verse 6. He said to me, it is done. So certain is the fulfillment of these things, says God, consider it done. All that he has decreed, he will fulfill, says the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. Christian friends, when Jesus spent those hours in agony upon the cross, when he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? When he took upon himself my filth and guilt and shame and sin. Who would have believed it would end here? In glory. But Christian friends, it's where all our stories will end. And one day we'll look back over these lives and we'll see the perfect plan of the perfect shepherd. And my life he has woven together with the thread of his grace. He does all things well. And bringing me at last home to be with him in heaven. I love Psalm 126. It's the exiles returning from Babylon. But actually the language is much more than that. It's the children of God coming home. Coming home to Father. Coming home to heaven. When the Lord brought back the captivity of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. And we are glad. Christian friends, our story ends with laughter and with singing and the thought we must be dreaming. But it doesn't end there. It's actually just the beginning, isn't it? It's just the beginning. And maybe we'll have a joy that's just too big for words. It'll be a joy inexpressible. A joy is even bigger than our mouths being filled with laughter and singing. A joy inexpressible and full of glory. So as we close, brothers and sisters, look ahead. See what awaits you. Here are promises to build your life upon. Let that day shape this day. I will give, verse 6, of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son. That's what lies in front of you. Now turn round, look behind you. What lies behind you? What have you been saved from? Verse 8. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Christian friend, can you have any doubts about the rightness of giving up all for Christ? To spend and be spent for him. And the madness of turning back. And my friend, if you're not a believer this morning, the madness of seeing all these things and deciding to turn away. Thirsty but refusing to come to Christ. That's madness, isn't it? For sin makes madmen of us all. Now is not the time to linger. The promised land lies before you. So brothers and sisters, onward. And upward.